guys, Jim Cox, and I'm here today with another interview with Andrew Wallace. He is the CEO of a group called Unseen UK, activist in terms of fighting human trafficking. And we had talked before. I recently reached out to him before COP26. I think you had posted an article about human trafficking and climate change in the relationship, which I have really always seen and really never got anybody to respond to. So I reached out and wanted to talk about it. And, you know, Andrew was quite kind enough to consent to share his thoughts after COP26. So Andrew, thanks for taking the time to chat today.
Jim, thank you for inviting me back. Great to be with you.
Awesome. So tell us a little bit about yourself. How did you get involved in working on the issue of human trafficking? What led you down this path?
Well, I founded Unseen 15 years ago as a result of coming across the issue, initially through a colleague of mine, where I used to previously work, who had come across the issue in Ukraine and actually ended up stopping somebody falling into the hands of a trafficker and had to pay the trafficker to get that individual out of that situation, which, you know, was kind of felt like a sort of movie scene almost. And then coincidentally, another friend of mine who spent their summers working trying to alleviate the social orphan problem in Eastern Europe and again in Ukraine, came back and said that she had discovered that kids, when they leave the orphanages, fall straight into the hands of traffickers and were disappearing. Now, this is at a time when like something like 400,000 people a year were disappearing from Ukraine, all suspected of being trafficked. And then, you know, so my interest was piqued, started seeing stories about it very, very occasionally in the press, and then probably following some trail on the internet, came across a historical article that talked about trafficking from Eastern Europe to the US and how they transited people through the UK and through regional airports. And one of the airports mentioned was my local airport. So in my mind, I started joining the dots, and then I did what I thought was normal. I ended up writing to all of my members of parliament, all the members of the city council and the chief constable of the police, saying, look, aware of this issue, now read this article, what's going on, what's happening in our neck of the woods. And to cut a very long story short, that ultimately led me to a conversation, an off the record conversation with a senior police officer, who basically lifted the lid on what was going on in terms of trafficking and exploitation. His frustrations at his inability to catch the bad guys and not look after the victims. And ultimately he challenged me to say, look, any idiot can write a letter that creates, you know, political stink, but actually, what are you going to do about it? And, you know, I was just compelled to say, okay, well, what do you need? And at that time he needed somewhere safe accommodation to support the victims that the police were finding. So I said, okay, I'll do that. I have no idea what that means and what I'm committing to, but I'll do it on one condition, that you're my first trustee, because at this point you know more than me. And the one thing I've learned in life is when people know more than you, hang out with them until you've got up to speed. So that was really sort of the genesis of Unseen, but never really wanted the organization just to be, you know, a very sophisticated safety net for victims, because that's kind of accepting that shit's going to happen. Yeah. And we want, like, excuse the phrase, we wanted to deal with the shit. And so we've always been, had this philosophy of we'll deal with, if you like, the micro, the individual, and the circumstances in which they have been exploited and help them. But we take all of that learning now to work with governments and with businesses and, you know, transform change in society.
So coming from having had the organization for 15 years, have you seen improvement or is it worse or has it changed?
Yeah, no, it's definitely changed. If I cast my mind back to, you know, when that first story, encountered me, like I said, it was very sporadic, very occasional stories in the press. Now, you know, my Google feed, you know, has regular, I mean, every day I am getting stories around the globe of, you know, situations of forced labor, modern slavery, domestic servitude, you know, the whole gamut there. So we're seeing much more media interest and reporting on it. So I think awareness is going up. You know, in the UK, I chaired the report that led to the UK's Modern Slavery Act. You know, in the US, in the last few years, we've seen the use of the Tariff Act to stop goods coming into the country that are tainted by forced labor exploitation. At the European Union level, they're going to bring in legislation that requires businesses to pay attention to human rights due diligence and also stop goods tainted by forced labor coming into the EU. The Australian government has enacted the Modern Slavery Act. The Canadian government is going to do that. So yeah, things are moving forward. At the same time, I think that principle of if you look for it, you'll find it is holding true. The more we look, the more we are prepared, whether it's governments or society, to, you know, have the courage to look under the stone of what's going on, the more we find. And, you know, there are global estimates. You know, the current global estimate is 40 million victims in situations of modern slavery. That's a guesstimate. It's based on, you know, limited data. We'll never have, if you like, the full data set to say, okay, categorically it's this. So it's always difficult to say, is it getting better? Is it getting worse? All I know in terms of we see more victims identified every year. I mean, I was on a call with the UK government just this week, and they were just saying the last quarter, the numbers have increased 33% year on year. Now, I know that's against the COVID year, but that tells you the rate at which we are finding victims in the UK. So The more we look, the more we find. But also, I think now we are within that sort of interesting space where we know the things that we need to do in order to tackle it, in order to deliver it. And the other thing, which I think internationally is sort of galvanizing and focusing minds, is the social development goals, the SDGs. 8.7 says we will have eradicated modern slavery by 2030. Well, that's 8 years away. We're not going to do it in 8 years.
Yeah,
I think this is a generational thing, but it's quite good to have that thing, you know, to prod government, prod businesses, prod society, and say, you know, we committed as a world to dealing with this issue. So how far past 2030 are we going to go? It's a bit like the COP argument. We need to do 1.5. We're not going to do 1.5, you know, as a result of Glasgow, but how far past that are we prepared to go? Or flip it around the other way, what more do we need to do to drag it back to that 1.5?
So we got like 20 rabbit holes to go down here. And
well, I thought I'd give you something. You know. I'll give you a selection.
It is rich territory, no doubt. So first question, you mentioned the Tariff Act being used in different places to address forced labor in supply chains. What are some examples of corporations using forced labor, like, that are able to be looked at, cited, documented?
So I think the two big ones recently that we've seen, the US and now Canada also has imposed its own Tariff Act as well. So the initial start point was against forced labor exploitation in Xinjiang, and particularly target, you know, the exploitation against the Uyghur population. And one of the things that the anti-slavery sector said straight away is, yes, Xinjiang, yes, Uyghurs, but don't lose sight of the fact that Uyghurs are forced all over China as well and end up in factories that are producing, you know, a myriad of goods. So it's always more complicated. But at least within Xinjiang, what they could say was, we know it's in cotton, therefore this is what we're going to target. And it was saying to businesses, look, here's all the evidence. Why are you still sourcing from these factories? Because it isn't as simple as, say, if you've got concerns of a factory in a different country, because you've got the Chinese state actively involved and threatening both those businesses or retaliatory maneuvers against the countries that are doing it. But so that's the first thing. We've also seen it within the Malaysian rubber industry. And that's really come to the fore because of the pandemic. So it's not as if we didn't know already. The UK High Commission, so the UK ambassador in Malaysia, that's one of the quirks of sort of the Commonwealth. If we have an ambassador in a Commonwealth country, they're called a High Commissioner. Bit of free info for our listeners there. They were already saying back to the UK government, look, there are forced labor allegations and concerns in these factories. Now, in those situations, you've got a migratory workforce. So Bangladeshi, Lao, Cambodian coming into Malaysia, and what was coming up from the workers was, here's the exploitation that's taking place. What the Tariff Act does is, if that evidence is submitted to US Customs and Borders, if it is of sufficient credibility, they then impose what's called a WRO, a withhold or release order, which means those goods can't enter the US economy at that point. And the US Customs and Borders then carry out those investigations. So we've seen a number of businesses targeted through that, because when US Customs looks at it, and this is a credit to the US government, they're saying, look, this is a serious issue. It isn't just China, it's everywhere. We've now got evidence. It then forces those companies to a decision. Either you address these issues, you know, whether it's recruitment fees, whether it's little or no pay, unsafe and unsavory working practices, tight accommodation, holding their visas, their passports, so they're not free to leave that situation, and so on. Unless you address those, you can't sell our goods. You can't sell your goods in the US marketplace. We've just seen Canada this week do exactly the same, again, against a Chinese supplier, but also looking at the rubber factory. And I just saw today on the wires, the US, Canada, and Mexico, there was a meeting at the White House between the president and the prime minister. And they again have reiterated they're going to tackle this issue. And so what those governments are saying, and we also saw this out of the G7 communiques, was it is no longer acceptable to have forced labor in your supply chains. And you think of the purchasing power of the G7 businesses and governments, you know, globally. That's quite a landmark statement to make. And then they task the trade ministers to really press into this. So I think, you know, to your earlier questions, are things improving? Yes, slowly we need to go faster. If you look globally, the vast majority of victims of modern slavery are in situations of forced labor, and they are found in the world's supply chains. Now, on top of that, you've also got the investor community really switched on to this as well now and saying, look, you need to be looking at these things. These are matters of due diligence. And also, we don't want to be investing in companies that are exploiting people. And so we are at that precipice where I think we're going to see a step change. And it's really pertinent that businesses take note of this.
So part of that conversation is, you know, shifting from shareholder activism to stakeholder activism, you know, having the shareholders not be driving the corporation to drive down costs and whatnot to the extent where they're relying on slave wages, slave labor to try to produce the lowest cost products in a marketplace. That seems like a very big ask in a world where you have growth concerns and economic concerns, which, you know, kind of freak out populations that, you know, they're not going to have a job the next day. You know, how do you transit that?
I think there's a number of things that I would say in response to that, which is, why are we in the situation that we now found ourselves in, you know, where for businesses, procurement is solely predicated on the amount of profit or margin that you can make. I used to work in the retail sector myself. And I think, you know, I'm poacher turned gamekeeper. And I think what we have to say is, look, business has in the last 40 years sort of created society's addiction to cheap goods, services, and labor.
Definitely.
And secondly, business has divorced itself from what I would say is both the value equation and the price equation. And so once you abandon value, then you can drive down on price. But that means people have no value attached to the things that they buy and they purchase. Yeah. And so that's why we've seen fast fashion come forward. That's why we have such a throwaway culture.
Yeah.
That's, you know, and I haven't even touched on the huge environmental impacts of that mentality, but you know, we're starting to see that in that process. So we have to address the addiction to cheap goods, services, and labor. We also have to say, if we carry on as is, the consequences of that addiction is that it is ultimately forced labor. Because if you put that pressure down the supply chain, as you work your way down the supply chain, there becomes no option other than, you know, maybe at best it's cutting corners, but at worst it is full on, I need not to be paying my labor.
Yeah. Yeah. And this isn't an issue that just remains somebody else's problem. Like we're talking about it in the context of you and I are living in industrial societies, and this is a problem happening overseas in other places. This is a problem that happens everywhere, and it's in our backyard. And yeah, I think by and large, most people are walking through their lives without any sort of clue that this is the reality, that it's actually right down the street from them.
Yeah. And I think also, I mean, it's that awful phrase, but it's a global problem. You know, it's global and local simultaneously. So, you know, for example, you know, today you've eaten food. You are thankfully, Jim, wearing clothes, as am I. And, you know, we've eaten food. Well, just by that, just doing life, we are personally connected to probably 40 or 60 slaves. Mm-hmm. So this touches us locally. You know, and you know, that thing of it's local, it is local because it's forced labor presents itself, you know, in the restaurants, in the takeaways, in the hand car washes, in the, if you like, the cash economy. But we also saw here in the UK, you know, in the last 12 months, Boohoo, a major sort of fast fashion retailer, sourcing from factories in the UK, where maybe it didn't hit the threshold of modern slavery, but it was labor exploitation, for sure. It was bad practices. I suspect, you know, we will see some incidents of modern slavery as we investigate more. And so, you know, it's an endemic and a systemic problem that we're trying to deal with. And you know, investors have a crucial role, but consumers also have a crucial role. You know, it's things like asking, well, who made my clothes and in what circumstances? And, you know, what is the impact of my purchasing on another individual? And, you know, the US and the UK, highly individualistic societies, but actually we are an interconnected world. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there are consequences. And we have got to transition from exploitative profit, you know, to sustainable profit. Mm-hmm. It isn't good enough just to say, well, it doesn't damage the planet if it damages people. And it isn't good enough to say it just damages people, but, you know, we don't give a damn about the planet. It is simultaneously both of those things, you know, and, you know, investors and consumers are increasingly concerned about this. Generation Z and beyond that are super concerned about this because they're looking at, well, what are we inheriting? And, you know, we touched at the top, you know, on the intersect with climate. There is a massive intersect with climate because it will have ramifications for people.
Interestingly enough, I literally 2 hours ago did a podcast with a person in the UK to discuss the concept of donut economics, this idea of valuing both the environment and society and living within our bounds. And this conversation falls right in that
bailiwick. Yeah, and I, Yeah, I spoke at a conference a few years back in Amsterdam on the whole circular economy and the whole donut economy around that. And it's as if we carry on as is, the scientists are telling us, and for me, I'm telling your listeners as a modern slavery expert, we carry on as is, we will be perpetuating the exploitation of individuals. And those individuals are somebody's son, daughter, mother, father, uncle, aunt, niece, nephew. That they are members of the human race. And like you said, Jim, that they're either here in the UK or where you are in the US, or but actually they're in every country of the world.
So, this really gets to an issue of what do we value, right? What are our values, our ethics? And in a sense, it's a spiritual question, right? Because it seems like when you have an economy that's being driven by this drive towards nonstop profit at any cost, it's devoid of any sort of spirituality or any sort of value of human life. How do we change that mode, that model of operation in people's minds and people's souls?
A great question. I think it comes back to initially the value that we attach to things. So let me give an example. So I had the privilege of going to India and visiting some of the factories where apparel is made. Now I was with a business, of course, they took me to the best factories and everything else. But even those best factories, you came out of them thinking, I would not want to work, a 10-hour shift in that environment. It's hard work, it's detailed work, it's skilled work. And yet I'm divorced from that when I purchase in the shop. I don't see that the whole, and that's if you like the construction bit. I don't see the whole manufacture of the cotton and the spinning and the dyeing and I was seeing the last bit, the cutting and the sewing together. But what I took away from that was I really value something when I purchase it because I know what goes into making it around that. Then I think I'm more of the persuasion of I need to stop and say, like, how much do I need to own in order to be, satisfied? And that's where you have to be totally countercultural. I'm back to, this addiction to cheap goods, services, and everything else. So, but as a consumer, you go, well, how much do I need? And I think, if I just reflect on, I'm just over 50. When I was growing up, I didn't need 12 t-shirts for the summer season. I pulled out the t-shirts from last year and they were great, unless they were holy and everything else. And sometimes holy was better because you were more on vogue. So, depending around that. And you didn't toss things away. Now, I think probably actually my generation are probably most at, our generation are most at guilt because we sort of imbibed that. Because I look at my kids and they understand, the concept of recycling. They understand actually, I want to buy vintage. I don't want to buy new. I understand the environmental impacts that this have. Obviously my kids also understand that, the people impact of those as well. So I think that, what's got to happen is we've got to really press the value pedal more on that. Now, on the flip side, I think there are certain structures within how businesses are constituted that means it's very hard for the value equation to come through. What do I mean by that? Well, things like quarterly reporting, that just drives a short-term mindset. Then this, what is an acceptable level of profit or return or growth? Then I think we also need to look at the natural world. The natural world has this rhythm of growth, you know, fruit and bounty, then die back, then winter and death, and then growth again. Mm-hmm. And yet we think, well, we can just grow and grow and grow and grow, and there's no consequences. Well, there are consequences. And I think, you know, we're now waking up to the consequences of the damage that we've put on the planet, because we think we can extract and extract and extract, and it's going to give, give, give. And the planet's now going, no, you know, around that. So that this, this extractive profit model, you know, which was, I just watched that film on what really happened in 2008 with the financial crash.
Which, you know, which that, film?
I knew you were going to ask me the title. It's on Netflix. You can find it on Netflix. Listen, listener, go and do some research. You can just Google it. I'm sure there are many films out there. But what struck me about that was what drove that crisis was, you know, if we're blunt, it was greed, but it was about how much can we extract, how much profit can we extract from the equation in that whole process without thinking of, well, what's the consequence of this? And we now all know what the consequences of that, you know, foreclosures, unemployment, financial crash, etc. I don't see any change in at the system level yet in terms of, we need to be thinking about what does sustainability look like? And we're going to have to get used to lesser returns, you know, not double digit growth and all of that. And sometimes, you know what, just growth of this is acceptable. It's almost like we're afraid to have these honest conversations. We're not afraid, but society is afraid to have, politicians are afraid to have this honest conversation. Mm-hmm. You know, here in the UK, post-Brexit, you know, all I hear from the government is, you know, we're going to do this and this and this. And I'm going, but that's just a regurgitation of what we've been trying to do. And it keeps leading to all of these problems. Why can't we just have this honest conversation? Do we think that the electorate isn't smart enough to understand there are consequences to carrying on as we are now? And so, you know, how do we do that societal shift? And so when you go and purchase, you're thinking, I want to purchase this and it's going to last more than a season. It's going to, you know, it's going to be in my wardrobe for 5-10 years. And then probably, you know, somebody will, it will then be recycled and reused and all of that.
So, I mean, we're more than a half hour into this and we haven't even touched on, you know, the main reason we had reconnected, which was climate change and COP26. How does climate change affect human trafficking?
Well, it already is. So I think that's so it's about, okay, so what are the things that we need to do so it doesn't impact more? So we are already seeing people on the move, forced on the move, because life can no longer be sustained and supported where they are. Mm-hmm. Or it is impacting businesses in terms of, we used to be able to do this. For example, we used to be able to grow this crop, we now can't, you know, whether it's water shortages or the climate has changed so that the growing cycle doesn't work. So then people are forced to move. They can't transition into something else. There aren't any other options. Then they're forced to move.
And do you have a specific example in mind of what you're thinking of? I mean, I do it myself, but I'm curious about what you're specifically talking about.
Well, for example, I mean, this came out of COP26. I think it was the president of Mozambique said, you know, they are already seeing that movement of people, you know, from the agriculture, which is a necessary part of the economy there, you know, away from that, it's no longer functioning. They're being forced into the cities. There aren't necessarily the replacement jobs. And, oh, oops, now we haven't got the agricultural, you know, produce coming to the fore as well. So it kind of looks sort of the problems sort of build up on each other in that whole process. There's going to be a lot around water shortages. So I think we're starting to see that, you know, where water is decreasing, that just, you know, regardless of whether it's agriculture or anything else, you just can't sustain life without water. So that then forces people to move. And on top of that, you know, the thing that we've seen over the last century, which is the massive urbanization. So the movement from, you know, the land to the city in that whole process. So maybe not like a specific case study as such, but saying we're already seeing that at global levels.
We're seeing it everywhere. I mean, it's not even in just Mozambique or the developing world, but India, China, the US. I mean, if you look at the example of water issues in the West in the US, I mean, it's massive in terms of what that means for populations that are going to have to move. They've basically built cities in areas that are just not going to be able to have the water supply that it needs to support that population.
Yeah, so we all know this is coming. And what we know is when people are forced to move, they are vulnerable. You know, if you're moving from A to B and you know at B you've got a job and everything else, there's some security. But that's, you know, so guess what? If I'm a trafficker and an exploiter, I go, oh yeah, I can get your job in B. You know, come with me, I'll arrange it all, and then boom, trap sprung. So it's never as simple as just saying that. So the estimate, I think, and Jim, you may need to correct my figures on this, but from what I was reading around COP26 was, the scientists are saying, okay, you know, we're not going to deliver 1.5. You know, at worst, it could be 2.4. If we hit 2, it's somewhere between, they then estimate, between 1 and 3 billion people will be forced to move. So I look at that and go, okay, well, that's disastrous in and of itself. But what does that then mean in terms of vulnerable migration? Because unfortunately, it is still going to be impacting most of the developing world and not the developed world. That's where it's going. That's the sharp end. We already have a flow from the developing world to the developed world that is economic, because people can't make a significant, a safe and secure living where they are. So they move to work to send money back to support family in that whole process. So that is only going to increase. And it's all we're doing is, if you like, pouring more into the funnel, into the system where exploitation can take place. So that's why we're saying there is a link between climate change, the impacts it has, the movement of people that will lead to more exploited people. And so, you know, back to my earlier bit, unless we have moved and unless we transition at pace to a much more sustainable profit model, and we think about the fact of, you know, hello, if we're going to pull more in, how are we going to, you know, how are we going to do that safely? We are just, you know, if you like, sitting on this sort of ticking system model that is just going to push out more exploitation in the whole process. Mm-hmm. Now, adding to that as well, the massive rise in terms of sort of populism, which is all in the developed world, which is kind of saying, you know, we screwed the planet, we screwed your countries, we exploited your countries, and now, you know, now we don't want to know, and you certainly can't come in. Mm-hmm. That isn't going to hold. You know, we just need to look at like Poland and Belarus and what's currently going on, or, you know, in different parts of Asia and Africa. And you know, it's a recurring problem.
Yeah, but the reality is that migration then feeds into that kind of conservative reaction to throw up more barriers, to become more reactive, and, you know, to drive wedges really that cut at the value of having good values, right? I mean, in a sense, that conservatism actually cuts at the heart of having empathy to deal with this situation and try to stop it in the first place.
And I think that there's another factor to it as well, which is the depersonalization of the issue. So it is this notion of the other, and the other isn't, well, at worst, they're not human, but it's kind of like, well, they're lesser than us and all of that. I think that plays into it as well.
Yeah.
But I would also argue, which is, we know what the drivers are and we know what the problems are. Why aren't we using our smarts to say, actually, how do we prevent this happening in the first place? What, you know, what is it that's driving this? And you know, for my field in terms of modern slavery, and I think I defined it, you know, the last time when we talked, which is it's this illicit commodity trade. The commodity is a human being to be bought, sold, and exploited in order to extract as much profit. Mm-hmm. And it's a supply and demand trade as well. And we've got an endless supply. And what I haven't seen, you know, what we keep banging on the drum on is, well, let's reduce the supply. How do we reduce the supply? What is it that forces someone to take, inordinate risks in order to try and support themselves and their family economically? Let's address those things. And some of the, we've said some of it's going to be climate. So what are the things that we can do so that those situations don't happen? Well, we have to make the sacrifices so we get to 1.5 and less. Mm-hmm. Therefore, the impact's going to be less. Then we have to say, how do we invest in those countries and in those people so that they have decisions? Because if you're a human being and your decisions are poverty, 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 or here's an opportunity. And yes, I know all the risks and I know about modern slavery and I know about traffickers, but it happens to everybody else. But me always kicks in. Why aren't we going, well, let's address those poverty issues that are at play. Mm-hmm. And some of the challenges I sometimes say to businesses, you strain everything to extract an additional 0.01% of market share in the US or in the UK. And there's a whole marketplace over there, notwithstanding our previous conversation about the ethics of business and all of that. But we have to make the world a more equitable place. Otherwise, we are just inviting those problems to come towards us. Mm-hmm. And then you're right, conservatism, populism kicks in the other. But I also know, I've not yet met a person when I've had the privilege of introducing them to someone who's been a victim of modern slavery, who isn't touched to their core, because they realize the person in front of them is just somebody like them. Mm-hmm. And I've met victims that have MBAs, and I've had victims that wouldn't know what a cell phone is, and all points in between. But they are a human being. And mm-hmm. when you hear the horrors of what another human being and what a society has done to them, you have to have a pretty cold heart of stone to not be moved and then not feel compelled to do something about it. Now, for a lot of people, they go, it's just too much, it's overwhelming, compassion fatigue, I can't deal with it. That's fine. But what are the things that you can do, mm-hmm. Through your consumerism, through your politics, through your activism? You can do, you don't necessarily have to be up close and personal to it. But like I said, we are all personally connected to this issue, and we can't get away from that. And so, William Wilberforce, who's lauded in the UK because he passed the first sort of transatlantic slavery act.
Mm-hmm. This was back in the 1800s, right?
Yeah. He said, once you know, and I always bastardize his quote, but once you have met modern slavery, or in his case, slavery, once you've seen it, you only really have two choices. And one is to do something about it, and the other is to completely ignore it. But you can no longer then say, I don't know about it.
Yeah.
And I think
you're either going to be part of the solution or part of the problem. There's no middle ground.
That's how we would say it today. Yeah.
So in that respect, is there a list of corporations, of companies that are addressing these issues and being proactive to kind of rethink, or not even rethink, but actually do what needs to be done to try to be good stewards in a holistic sense? Like if you're a business and you're dealing with, you have part of a supply chain in India, are you actually being proactive to improve the world that those workers live in India, since they're part of your supply chain? Are there those corporate actors?
There are some better actors out there. We don't have like a definitive, here's the top 100 yet around that. So It's a bit like, you know, ESG, environment, social governance. You know, we're pretty good at defining how people are doing on carbon now, because you know, you can track it, you can monitor it, report on it, etc. Same with governance around that. The S bit, I like to say the S is slippery, because it's a little bit more, how do we actually quantify? But I think we're getting there quite quickly. So I think within time, you know, we will have both businesses and independent evaluation of how businesses are doing on the S around that. So who's doing better on that? Obviously, you know, the transparency in supply chain legislation that California had, and then we had got through the ones they reacted in the UK, and now Australia, Canada's looking at it, etc., is part of that. The UK government's going to upgrade it and improve it, and hopefully, you know, they'll listen to the smarts on how to do that better. So I think in time, just as you can now quite easily go, well, this company is much more carbon neutral, and it isn't just the company telling you. So, you know, a nod to greenwashing, but you know, here's the independent. In the US, you can look up top 100 green companies, you know, in apparel or in this or this, and it's independently verified in that whole process. We're, you know, I think in terms of exploitation of people, we're about 10 years behind where carbon was 10 years ago, maybe 15. But I think we'll catch up at speed on that. So, you know, there are already the beginnings of these sort of lists of these companies are doing well, you know, so within apparel, you know, there's some, I'm working around that. So I think those standards will come in. So the consumer has more information in terms of what they want to do. But that doesn't stop a consumer asking questions of the business itself and saying, tell me in detail what you're doing, or, you know, doing research. And you know, we have this incredibly powerful tool. It's called the internet. It's not difficult to find out what is going on. You know, you've got businesses like Adidas and Nike that have put the whole of their supply chain on a map, you know, online. So you can see where things are made in that whole process. You know, you can use, you know, Google Newsfeed or Bing Newsfeed, and just say, give me stories on, you know, I have one on transparency in supply chains, on forced labor, on domestic servitude, on sexual exploitation, on child trafficking, on labor, blah, blah, blah. You can find out these things of what's going on. And I'm a huge advocate for people informing themselves. I also, you know, recognize that, you know, as an NGO, you know, we have a critical role in informing the public, and we do. You saw my piece on climate. You know, it was putting it out there, saying, look, there is this intersect between the two issues. You've got the investment community really paying attention to this. So I think this is why it will speed up, because they'll be going, you know, we're going to rank businesses like this. And once that happens, business mentality kicks in, going, well, where am I in the overall rankings, and where am I to my competitors? And I want to get ahead. Because if I don't get ahead, then, you know, I'm going to be going backwards, and I'll be out of business before I know it. So it's coming, but it is still way too difficult. Mm-hmm. It should be as simple as, you know, if you walk into a store, your phone should alert you to, well, this company is an F on labor exploitation, and it's a B on climate, and its governance is a C, and, you know, and then you let the consumer make the choice in that whole process. But at the same time, you know, there's a role for government and behavioral insight teams to be re-educating us as citizens into how we live and how we purchase and how we interact with the world does have repercussions, not just for us, but for our children and our children's children and so on. And I think, you know, that will come. You know, my takeaway out of COP is, yes, there was some progress, but it wasn't enough. So, you know, we're going to live with those consequences. And when you look at the youth climate activists, we need to listen to them, because it's their future that we're actually talking about, not ours. You know, we'll be worm food by the time some of this kicks in. And, you know, and back to your point of, you know, is it a spiritual thing? You know, the major world faiths say there isn't this divide between sacred and spiritual. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a Western Greek concept. Yeah, but all the major world faiths say no, it's not. You know, that there is how we live our lives, how we interact with our fellow human beings, and how we interact with the environment really, really does matter, mm-hmm. and it has real consequences. And so, yeah, raising these issues, you know, broadcasting about these issues, Jim, hopefully forces the listeners to have those internal conversations with themselves in terms of, oh, it does matter. It is important. Mm-hmm. You know, it touches the here and now as well as the future.
That's a great statement. I'm curious if, as hypothetically, let's say I'm working within a corporation and the predominance of education in terms of economics, especially in the United States, I don't know what it's like elsewhere, but it's all within this capitalist model. And, you know, especially in terms of the past 30, 40 years, the shareholder model of capitalism, that everything is designed to function in this specific way. Is there educational material in terms of a course that somebody who is in, let's say, going to business school for a business degree, or somebody who's working within a company, can take a course to be educated to be able to integrate this idea within their actual work? Is there that kind of material that's out there?
Back to this film that I can't remember the title of, but it's on Netflix, that our listeners will find. Like, one of the scariest things for me was just how broken the whole system is. Mm-hmm. So the teaching of economics at university, well, look who's teaching and look who's sponsoring it. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of like, and they were the ones that created the financial crash. And yet they're still spouting it. We know what we're doing. This is how the economy works. Yeah, but the way that your economy worked, it resulted in 2008. And yet you're still teaching it. And nobody's saying, hang on a moment. You know, explain that to me again. You know, why, you know, Einstein's theory of insanity, you know, it's just writ large. You know, you keep doing the same things and thinking you're going to have a different outcome. Well, you're not in that thing. I think, look, if people want to start somewhere, in terms of just informing themselves, read something like The Donut Economy by Kate Raworth, you know, as a starting point. Read about the circular economy. Look at what the B Corp movement is doing, you know, both in the US and in Europe. Those are good places to start. If you're in a corporation, you're thinking, okay, now what do I do? Well, A, first, it takes courage. Oh. So it's grab courage and then start asking questions. Questions like, why is it that one of the biggest companies in the world, Unilever, don't quarterly report? They said, we're not going to do that. We're not going to, you know, fall into that trap. We want to build for the long term, and we want to not damage the environment and not damage people. Now, as far as I can see, Unilever is still an incredibly successful company. So sometimes it's, you have to, another film analogy, it's almost like the Matrix moment. You're going to take the red pill or the blue pill? You know, and we're living in this system of just perpetuating a myth that nothing else is work or it won't work. And there are examples out there, you know, B Corp, Unilever, Patagonia, and on and on and on. I could go of companies that are saying, we're not gonna swim in that direction. We think we can swim in a different direction upstream and still work and not damage people and not damage planet. And still, you know, deliver profitability and still being able to invest in the business. And then thirdly, be a student of history. Mm-hmm. You know, this phenomena is only 40 years old. And yet it's wrought more financial destruction than the previous hundreds of years. You know, even in the, you know, you look back in the US to before, you know, the shareholder mentality kicked in. Were there successful businesses? Yeah. Were people able to grow their businesses? Yeah. Was there employment? Yeah. Were there problems? Of course there were. But those fundamental assertions that, oh, no, it can only happen if it's this way, are not true when you, you know, you step back and you look at the bigger span of things. And then look at other economic models around the world. And here's an interesting thing. You know, if you look at the indications of happiness, wealth, and mental well-being, which countries and which economies are at the top? Well, primarily the Nordic countries. What's their economic model? What's their social structure? That, now, let's be clear, I'm not saying they're perfect, but it's interesting things to arm yourself with to question the status quo.
Totally, completely agree. I think that's a good note to end with. If people want to learn more about your work, how can they do so?
Yeah, you can go to our website, unseenuk.org. And if you want to get in touch with me, there's a contact us page on there. Just put in the header, Jim Cox's podcast.
Well, I appreciate you taking the time to chat today and really open a lot of eyes, I think. And this is an issue that obviously it's not going away anytime soon, but, you know, we just got to keep chipping away and, you know, making people see. So
thanks, Jim. Pleasure to be with you.
I'll talk to you soon.